Appreciate you all coming at the, I think, the last session of the afternoon. I'm Molly Tamarkin, and I was this year's chair of the Evolving Technologies Committee here for EDUCAUSE. I want to get one order of business out of the way before I talk about our program. Just to remind you that there are online evaluations for you to evaluate the session. Okay, Evolving Technologies is a committee that's been around for about 11 years. This past year, we decided to change a few things about the committee, see how that worked. We wanted to be to do a little bit more outreach, so we did a couple of things. We tried a blog, and we're going to keep that up for the next year. And we also decided to change how we were doing our presentation to have Ignite-style presentations and to solicit some presenters from the community. And so the fruits of that labor are the presentation today. Our focus also for the year, instead of looking at specific technologies in and of themselves, has been on the impact of specific technologies on the IT profession, on our community, and on our lives. And we're calling this the Evolving You. Shelley will talk about that a little bit more, and our article this year will focus on that as well, or is focusing on that. I'd like to introduce the committee members who are here. If you could just stand up and wave to the audience so if people want to give us feedback, they can talk to you. Thank you. All right. And I want to introduce Shelley, who's convening the session, or who's leading the session. Shelley Rodrigo is faculty in English and Film Studies at Mesa Community College. Her work has been published in a variety of journals and collections. She has been a terrific member and contributor to the committee the past year, and next year she'll be co-chairing the committee with me. So, Shelley?
Thank you, and just want to ask everyone's indulgence each time as we click over to the new set of slides. There'll be a quick transition. Hello, my name is Shelley Rodrigo. I'm an English faculty member at Mesa Community College, and I represent an evolving technology, the Evolving You 3.0. As a You 3.0, each morning at this conference, I've struggled to decide which pieces of hardware to carry with me. As many of you right now are carrying laptops, how many of you are carrying laptops? Raise your hand. Okay. Mobile phones, hands up. iPads, other things. I saw a notepad, old school. Anyone got a Kindle, another e-reader with them? Very cool. So how many of you are carrying more than one device? Very good. Although You 3.0s like their gadgets, they understand that the essence of technology is nothing technological. You're here, therefore you are the Evolving You 3.0, and we want you to share it. This year, the Evolving Technologies Committee identified you as the technology user as Evolving Tech, and hope you'll tell us about it. So please, get on the website, Twitter. We set up a Wafidi. If you go to Wafidi or that text message there, we'll collect all your you. But to help you with that, we want to talk to you a little bit about why You 3.0. In an evolving You 3.0 world, technologies have become more about consumers and individual mobility. You know, the technologies are all about you. Does it mean technology industry has become Burger King? We know sometimes our students make it feel that higher education has become that way. And do their technology consumption habits support that mind frame? I admit some of mine do. I'm You 3.0 because most of my hardware technologies have names and are part of my family. Last night I was reading on my iPad Zoe before bed. This morning I was working on this presentation on my MacBook Balin. I named my desktop computer at home Starbuck, yes, from Battlestar Galactica, and she acts feisty like the character. In an evolving You 3.0 world, technologies have become more about individual processes and services. People use what technology they want, when and where they want it, to achieve their specific goal, and the best part is, we all do it differently. For example, I'm You 3.0 because I'm beyond just Googling. Instead, I use Google's Wonder Wheel, Timeline, Scholar, News Archive, and Alerts to help me find and track information. I also accept that while researching, my writing students will start with Google and probably read the Wikipedia page first. And it's my job to not only help them learn the services, Google, Google Scholar, and ooh, the library databases, but it's also to help them improve their information literacy processes. Where did they find the resource? Why is it authoritative, credible, reliable, and how will they cite it? In an evolving You 3.0 world, technology issues have become more about how individuals manage large amounts of data and security risks. Computers are no longer just for the super rich or super smart. We all have the tools and the data. Now we need to know how to use the tools and interpret the data in both sophisticated and safe ways. I'm U 3.0 because I've had to become much more legally savvy to use various third-party technologies I think better facilitate learning. I now know much more about FERPA, copyright, accessibility, and privacy than I ever imagined I would need to know. However, this is useful because it helps me share this knowledge with my students and my colleagues to make them more info and techno-literate, and knowing these laws helps them construct, develop, contribute knowledge for future use. In an evolving U 3.0 world, technology issues have become more about how individuals personalize complex tools and communicate their processes to others. I learned to drive in Southern California, and we know that, like the internet, there are multiple ways to get to one location. Sometimes the fastest way is by no means the shortest. With all technology options, people spend time developing and streamlining their own processes. I am U 3.0 because I love sharing complex layered technology tips and tricks for helping faculty more easily process people, paper, and projects. For example, at the beginning of the semester, collect updated student contact information, something that can output as a spreadsheet, upload that form as a spreadsheet to Google Contacts to make student groups, and when you wake up sick one morning like I did about a week ago, you can quickly notify the students you've canceled class via the contact group, both by email and using Google Voice to their text messages. But I'm just one evolving teacher. We also want to share with you how other IT leaders on their campuses are evolving individuals, buying technologies and services that work for their individual institutional context, sharing strategies for being productive, safe, and secure. And if that image didn't jive with you, maybe it'll jive with the four who are about to come up here today. The four people we have for you: Jennifer Sparrow, Director of Emerging Technologies and New Ventures Innovation Space. Isn't that a great title? Virginia Tech. Robert McDonald, Associate Dean for Library Technologies and Digital Libraries at Indiana University. Kyle Bowen, Director of Informatics at Purdue. And Emily Jones, Instructional Designer at Johns Hopkins. And like me, they're going to come at you fast and furious, Ignite style, 20 slides transitioning every 15 seconds for 5 minutes total. Don't forget, you are the evolution. So pull out that device you brought. There was a lot of hands. Hopefully they still have enough battery power left, though. And tell us how you are evolving U 3.0.
So I thought I talked fast, but Shelley wins the prize for that one. Thanks, Shelley. Oh, not for that one, though.
Not for that one. Can we go to, there we go. See, thank you for
perfect. Okay. Hi, everyone. I'm here to talk to you about e-readers. Shelley sort of stole my thunder because I was going to get up here and actually ask you what e-readers you're using. So, again, how many folks are using a Kindle? How many folks are reading books off their iPad? How many folks are reading off their iPhone? All right. So I am rapidly approaching 40 and found that I am in love with this device, not because it does all the other things that it does, but because I can read in bed at night and not disturb anyone else in my household, particularly my husband. So I want to go back. Oh, I'm not talking quickly enough. Right there we have the Gartner Hype Cycle. We notice that they'll come down there. We'll go through these e-readers very quickly. Gartner Hype Cycle is coming down on the bottom end of e-readers are coming down on the bottom end of that for industry, but I think in education we're still looking at what these tools are, what their potential is, and how we can go from there. First piece that folks are looking at is what content is available. So how do you choose a device and what content it becomes available? Kindle was a big deal. We found out that it didn't necessarily share nicely with EPUBs, had some cool tools in addition to what it had, the e-ink, which gave it a nice long battery life, but didn't go from there. One of the issues that we look at is display size. Again, you can look at everything from a 7-inch to, you know, your nice 3 inches here, depending on what you're looking for. Are you looking for a backlit screen? Are you looking for e-ink so that there's some sort of ease of use on the eyes? What is the performance? And particularly when we're talking about this in higher education, is the performance piece is how quickly do the pages turn? How quickly does the page refresh? When we're turning the pages, is there a lag time? The first thing I did when I picked up my Kindle, which I had before my iPad but after my iPhone, was to try and turn the page like this. That doesn't work. So what is it that students need for performance? Wireless, I love. I live in the mountains of Virginia, so if we are not getting a good signal to download equipment, download pieces, that becomes an issue. I shouldn't have to go stand at the top of the mountain, and we need to be aware of that as we get these devices out to students. Storage space becomes a clear issue when we're talking about how much students are going to be downloading and what they're looking at. And is multimedia a critical piece? Right now we're looking at a lot of e-books, e-textbooks that are just simply a PDF version or a digitized version of what we already have and purchase in the bookstore. I think as we go and look at the evolution of this, we're going to sign more multimedia materials that are going to go along with that. Again, advanced features. Can it surf the internet? Can it have a dictionary for you? Does it take notes? Can you export those notes? Can you share those documents? Does it fold the laundry? That's really what I want. Battery life becomes an issue. Again, as Shelley mentioned, if your devices still have battery, that's terrific. The iPad, you've got anywhere from 8 to 12 hours. If you're using it all the day, you can get up to 14 days with the Kindle is what I've been told. Costs become a critical issue when we're talking about these devices. Certainly, if you're talking about an e-reader, this is going to be a supplemental device to an existing computer that students already have. So you have to consider those cost issues. It's not St. Patrick's Day, but I love my students here because they're going to give us great feedback. And the feedback that we've gotten that we've collected from other folks, including Penn State, is this doesn't love me back like my book does. It doesn't smell good. It doesn't feel nice like my book does. So we have to take those student considerations into student feedback into consideration when we're making these decisions. Again, availability of content. I'm a little embarrassed. This is my Amazon page, so you can see what I read a bunch of trash when I'm not looking at anything else. So how is the content available? What is the pricing structure? If we're talking about e-textbooks here, what cost issues are we looking at? Is this something that a student can get for a semester and then will have to pay again beyond that? The critical reading piece when we're talking about e-readers, what do we do for students in terms of giving them the tools that they're comfortable using and getting there? So how do we do critical reading and does the device support that? Again, the content for higher ed, if it's an e-textbook, is it free? Is it a paid piece? Is it open source? Does it have additional content? Can I take what notes I've done here and make them part of a collective knowledge? Those are all good questions to ask. Future issues and really a current issue. I should have had a slide in there that said current issues. Accessibility. So a huge issue. I know someone out in Arizona is dealing with that, I think, in terms of whether or not these are accessible and available. And whether or not the content is going to keep up with the devices that we have. So those are sort of some future issues. Again, some references here just from the folks or the information that we've had there, the Gartner e-learning cycle. Is that it? I'm done. Thank you.
Tell me when you are ready. All right, I guess I can go ahead and start. My name is Robert McDonald, and I'm at Indiana University. And my Ignite talk here today is going to be a little bit more about a personal history with technology and how I've evolved as a person into my 3.0 self and what I'm doing now with technology, which is more about people than it is about technology. Take a look at this. Go to Italy. Be a cobbler. This is graffiti from University of Chicago's Regent Street Library. I really love this kind of graffiti and how you find it in Flickr. This could have been me. Go to Italy, be a composer. Go to Italy, you know, work with computers a little bit. Because I did work with computers. I built Heath kits. I worked with, you know, Apple First Generations, which is what this is here. And it's also a piece of art by Mark Richards. The more I got involved with them, the more I realized I could use those to compose music, and that's what I did. I really had a fun time doing that, and then I got into bigger and better computers, right? I started expanding my network and hooking myself up with bigger and better machines and bigger and better storage mechanisms, and that's how I evolved over time to really get into doing the research of finding out what's there for technology and how it can support both humanities as well as other efforts in colleges. And I went to college, right? This is a great picture of my current university, Indiana University. And I liked it so much I got 2 or 3 degrees and I didn't really want to leave, right? So I just kept hooking myself up with bigger and bigger machines and more technology that the university paid for. But guess what? I also like the libraries. And so I really like the idea of being able to take that knowledge and pour it out into people's technologies and networks and make it available to them. So I worked on that for a little while and I thought, you know, I was doing a good job with that. You know, I really like doing that. I like working with the technology of libraries. But guess what? I said, let's be a lawyer. You know, you're supposed to be able to see this as a South Carolina legal reporter. So I did that for a while. And guess what? They were giving out laptops at the law school. So guess what I got pulled into? I got pulled into reformatting the laptops and handing them out and doing tech support because they really didn't have enough people at the time to do that. And then after I mastered that form of Windows, which was kind of lame at the time, but it's still fun to play with those expensive laptops at the time, which were about $2,000, which would now cost us about $800, I started playing around with all the different versions of Linux. And so I got to the whole thing of moving Solaris to Linux and moving Unix to Linux. Everybody thought I was crazy because they said, that, you know, that's just not going to work. It's not going to be operational. It's not going to support what we need for universities, right? Well, then I started playing with more stuff, started doing stuff with Apache and websites and Ruby and expanding my knowledge base out to content management systems like Drupal and having fun with about that. But guess what? The people, you know, it's the users and the people who contribute the code and the people that you manage who contribute the code and build the infrastructure that your organization runs on. That became the important part to me at some point after I had to manage more people and manage more projects. And, you know, one of my first experiences with that was with learning management systems. And I've got Sakai up here because I worked with all the others. And I was on all the other committees for three or four different universities that picked one or the other and did this and that with them. And then I saw how Sakai could really change how developers that you managed could contribute code and do wonderful things in terms of growing them both from developers into lead developers and then into managers for that area. And so then I went to Indiana University and started working with the Quali Foundation types of stuff and saw how for that organization in particular, it really did grow stuff. Well, guess what? My first day at Indiana University, they said, hey, there's this project called the Open Library Environment. And they're thinking about building an open library system, so you should call Duke and check it out. So I did. And I had a good time that year working with Lynn O'Brien at Duke and a whole bunch of other people who came around this from all over this country and elsewhere internationally. So we took it to a build project, and now we're joined the Quali Foundation to get some administrative support from those guys, but to completely build our open library environment using community collaboration as well as the Rice middleware. And guess what? I just build community after community. I've worked on that with Olay. I'm working on that with variations on video. I'm working with that on Vivo software application that's being funded by NIH. I'm working with the guys at ArchivesPost to see if they can build their own community. And I'm also working with the HubZero folks to see how their hub can connect to some of my other communities in the digital humanities. And so that's how I evolved from being someone who really loved to play with big computers and got to building big communities of people. Thanks a lot.
Let's go. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Kyle Bowen. I'm Director of Informatics, and I'm also a purveyor of the mainstream. I'd like to talk to you a little bit this afternoon about gestures. Now, I don't mean those gestures that you use when you're driving your car. I mean the gestures that you use while using your phone. You see, we can't talk about the evolution of mobile technology without talking about gestures. Now, did you know that they all have names? There's the tap and the double tap, but we also have the drag, the flick, the press, the pinch, the spread, and the swipe. See, I've memorized them all. See, it depends on what phone you have in terms of what mobile gestures you choose to use. But there's one mobile gesture we all use, the finger phone, right? It's common to us all, but the problem is that the finger phone, phones don't look like that anymore, right? Am I right? So it's time. Our contracts are up. It's time to upgrade, ladies and gentlemen. Let me introduce you to the all-new magical iHand, you see. It has the same basic features as the finger phone, except for now... Well, you can make phone calls, right? But you can also surf the web, and look, you can watch YouTube videos on it. Works kind of the same way. It's waterproof, and the best part, it's always within arm's reach, right? And the best part, if you're ever caught in a fight, it always beats rock, right? And I bet even Steve Jobs carries one of these. That's right. See, we can't talk about implementing mobile devices, or we can't talk about changing the mobile world without talking about these kinds of technologies, without looking at this a little bit differently. At Purdue, we've developed new mobile technologies like Hotseat and Mixable as a way to engage students in kind of an open collaboration process. In order to do this, what we have to do is leverage the environments that are native to those students, things like Facebook, things like their mobile devices. In order to do that, we have to consider that those students are going to use that technology a little bit differently than we do we look at our standard technology today. The challenge that we have... is that we are no longer managers of technology. We are now entrepreneurs, right? We make investments in technology. We have to make good investments in those technologies. And we have to think about it a little bit different way because we never know which one's going to take off. And we have to be willing to accept risk, and we have to be willing to make changes. And so, you know, in the mid-1980s, there was this company called Smith Corona, which maybe you've ever heard of. They were an innovator in the area of typewriters. And when they recognized in the mid-80s that their business was threatened by the personal computer, they knew they had to make a change. And so what they did was, is they made an investment in R&D. They knew that if they could make a better typewriter, then they could get their customers back. How do you think that worked? Yeah, they went out of business in the mid-90s. Right? The reality is we have to avoid those types of situations, and we can do that by placing small bets on multiple technologies, especially in the teaching and learning space. We have to be agile like that. By making this, we can avoid the challenge that we currently have of feeling like we're locked into technology because of the pain it took to invest them. I've heard people talk about their projects as if they were a child, but in actuality, they should think about them like a goldfish, where you're happy to have it, but if things don't go well, I'm perfectly fine sending it down the drain. New technologies, they have to be proven, and they have to be proven through research. Do they make a demonstrable difference? This means that we have to recruit our faculty to not only use them, but we have to recruit our faculty to conduct research. We have to make our technology a part of their research agendas. We have to make technologies that are simple and easy to use, like escalators. If you think about escalators, they're great technology because they never break down. They can only ever become stairs. Even when they're not working, they still work. In an era where we look at things like flip cameras and YouTube, the level of quality has come down, right? And this has opened doors for us. It makes it easier for us because we are willing to sacrifice functionality, or I'm sorry, if we're willing to sacrifice quality if we can make it easy to use. Now, as our institutions, they are large vessels that turn slowly, right? And so what we have to do is move quickly to get in front of them so that we can. By the time these vessels turn, then we can already be there to adopt the new technology. So if you're like me, you struggle with this notion of, what does that mean? Well, you know, in IT, we're taught to be operationally excellent, you know, uptime all the time. But in reality, what we need to do is be strategically important. And I struggle with that idea until I came up with this. It was like, I answer this question. Is it strategically important? So at the end of the day, what we have to do is encourage a community of people to rally around an idea. Right? We have to get these crowds in a mass to do something. So let me do a quick demonstration. Knock, knock. Nobody. I just want to show you I can motivate you all to do something. Right? That's the idea. That's what we have to do is get communities of people to work together to solve common problems. 1 second. It's switching, I promise. In closing today, let me leave you with this idea. Rule number one to getting the job done, stop asking permission. And always remember that you can't run from trouble. There's no place that far. Thank you very much.
All right. My name is Emily Jones. I'm from Johns Hopkins University, and I'm here to talk about better living through data and all of the great data that we have at our fingertips. For point of reference, my first name is the sixth most popular baby name this year, down from number one, and my last name is the fourth most common surname in the United States. I started learning about where I came from because my coworkers at The Ohio State University gave my husband and I DNA testing kits from the National Genealogical Project. I'm from Southern Ohio. This was a wedding gift. They wanted to make sure that we weren't related. They're very kind. I knew a lot about my family. I knew that we came from Romania, and I'd found stuff online, historical documents, and I knew that we had supposedly had some property there. We were minor royalty, except that when the wall fell down in 1989, we got letters, and it turns out that we're actually counterfeiting gypsies. But nobody in my family wanted to believe this. So for my grandfather's 90th birthday, I sent away his DNA. We know that the gypsies came out of India at about 1000 AD, and guess what happened? Scientific data came back to me. It was like manna from heaven. So this year, 23andMe.com had a $99 sale, so you could get their ancestry kit, you could get their health kit for like $100 versus $500. So I said, okay, I'm going to take advantage of this. So now I have all this information about my health history, my drug sensitivity, carrier status. I can download my genome, browse my data, run it against an open source Snippedia, and then for $2 use a Prometheus tool. In 5 minutes, I have everything about myself downloaded in 18 megs on a flash drive that I can then walk across the street to Johns Hopkins Hospital, the number one hospital in the country. And what happens then? What happens to my nursing students when they get a patient like me? That's what's really scary. What happens to my insurance? So I already know a lot about myself, okay? I know, thanks to the EDUCAUSE Leadership Institute, that I am an ENTP, which means that I am a visionary and an inventor. But I think it's a little bit like South Park, the underpants gnomes. So it's like step one, underpants, step two, step three, profit. That's kind of what ENTP means to me. So this is the data that I used when we moved to Baltimore. If you're not familiar with Baltimore, I wasn't. I knew it mostly from The Wire. This is the 2010 Baltimore City murder map. Okay? this is my Google map, my personal map. I picked the neighborhood with the least murders and the most water. So we're surrounded on three sides, and if we have to, we sail now so we can make a quick getaway. All right? So it's very important. But most of our data that we get right now doesn't come from traditional sources. The Baltimore Sun laid off over 60 people last year, and that wasn't the first year it happened. Their best source of news is their blogs now, written by crime reporters Peter Herman and Justin Fenton, who is my Twitter buddy. This picture is something that he took about a month ago from 25 feet away from my office. This is the front door of the School of Nursing during the Hopkins shooting incident that we had. Okay, we had students in clinical rotations on the eighth floor of Nelson. That was one of the scariest days ever. So how do we use all of this information? This is my personal learning network, and this is the old style. These are all the CMSs that I've used before, and not one of them has a decent e-portfolio tool. But what we really need is not an e-portfolio. It's a life portfolio, because all of these systems didn't exist when those systems were built. Right? And we get all of this data back. I know how many friends I have, how much yarn I have. I know all of this stuff about myself, but there's no one place for anybody else to know this stuff about me. They'd have to know everything about me. This is a graph that my nursing educators asked me to make up about my background, because they went into nursing and then education, so they were interested in the other way around. But this doesn't even attempt to capture all the things that happened in my master's degree, okay? And since my master's degree, I'm learning how to play the ukulele. I've gotten my scuba diving certification. I do improv. I do yoga. I make bourbon, bacon, pecan, artisan ice cream, okay? Who's tracking those skills? How am I going to get a job based on that? And that's not even counting the bio data. So this is my Fitbit. I think I'm wearing it right now, but I won't tell you where. This is how many steps I've taken, over 11,000 today. It tracks my sleep data, my sleep efficiency, how active I am during the day. This is what I did before I came to this. I'm like a Boy Scout, always be prepared. I'm terrified of bed bugs. You will be happy to know that the Hilton Anaheim is bed bug free, thanks to bedbugregistry.com. Okay. So what does it mean? So Gladwell talks in his book, The Tipping Point, which I'm sure everybody in this room has read, about connectors and mavens. And I think there's something that's really a combination of both. And it comes from living with all of this data. And it means that we're aggregators and we're actors, okay? So this is still a work in progress. I'm like a good scientist. I have all this data, and now I'm trying to find the experiment. And so if you want to connect with me, if you have an idea about what we do with all of this, how we create the life portfolio to better show us who we are and our students are, let me know. Thanks.
Well, and I think that's okay. Well, what's interesting is I think with the evolving news, on the one hand, the news keeps telling us that we're becoming better multitaskers. But then, because we're in education, we know the brain research that says it does not exist. So it's this interesting tension, and it's even part of, I think, the point of what we were saying. One of the evolving U 3.0 things is about knowing the data, and we know that it doesn't work. So accepting that things slip when we try to juggle too much. Yes, please. We'll start to the left and move to the right. Thank you.
Emily.
Oh, yeah. Maybe that's an idea. If you want to come up here. The question was to Emily, why would she want one life portfolio?
Because when I go to a job interview, not that I would ever leave Johns Hopkins, or when we send our students out on job interviews, the best thing that I can take really to represent me is a piece of paper. And that doesn't cut it anymore for me. And it doesn't cut it for my students. You know, I work a lot with the cognitive domain, and I really like the revision of Bloom's taxonomy and stuff, where creating is at the top of the higher order thinking skills. So I think really when you're creating stuff in this digital environment and you're creating things online, that you need to have a place for people to experience those, and a sentence on a resume isn't really that anymore. It's kind of like a picture captures 1,000 words. I think kind of an example or an online experience captures 1,000,000. So.
I see hands. Did someone want to engage that? Or? But it's a lot more work, maybe, is what the point you're getting at. But I appreciate the comment on that in a couple of years it'll be U 4.0 or U Infinity. I think just to say that part of our switch just for this this year for the Evolving Tech Committee and shifting to you is what we see as just kind of the beginning of an overall switch of just thinking more about the, and I'm thank you for the term, the ecology of evolving technologies, that it's not just the hardware or the application, but it's everything around it. And where next year we'll be talking more about, you know, the technologies again, what people want from us. The discussion will be much more, I think, holistic. And maybe that's even some of the question of why would you want a single combined U portfolio, because then is that the place where you actually can construct the identity, virtual identity of you that you want? But I'd even ask, is that real? But that was another question I've been having on with someone on Twitter during the conference. Other comments or questions?
Oh, that's a fantastic question. So, the question is, and let me make sure I have this right, is that in terms of making small bets on multiple technologies, what is the implication for support of those technologies? Am I right? So, and actually, this is a fantastic question because it dovetails really well into this morning's keynote. For the parts of it that didn't involve science and microfabrication, these kinds of things, there was a message in there that dealt with scale, which is really, I think, getting at what you talk about. So how do you take technologies like this and scale them? And I have to agree with how he presented it. Scale, the traditional notion of scale in terms of, let's say, your LMS, is that you provide a cookie-cutter solution, and you make decisions on behalf of the people who use it in terms of how they will use it. And then you more, I don't want to say impose, maybe that's a little too strong, but that's essentially what happens, is that you create the fenced-in area in which they can play. I think if you adopt a scenario where you're developing or implementing multiple diverse technologies, and if they're simple, then you don't have that same challenge. You basically offload that decision-making on the front end onto the user. So I like to say that we provide them with the field, the stick, and the ball, and to see what kind of game that they can come up with. And these technologies, they're not always for everyone. But the idea is they have to be simple, and they have to just work. And so that's where, you know, how much does YouTube support their users versus how many users they have? How much training did you require when you first signed up for Facebook? You know, how many of you use Gmail? Did you ever get trained on that? Right? So these technologies, it happens all the time. We are capable of delivering technologies that don't require support. And I think one of the things we find is with our tool, Hotseat, which is a back channel tool, in reality, offering a back channel discussion is kind of a spontaneous thing. The idea of providing tech support in that scenario is ridiculous because, oh, well, I want to engage this class in conversation in real time, but wait, let me get on my phone and call somebody to help me connect. That just can't happen. So that's where it gets back to. It has to be simple and it has to just work. Sorry, long answer to what was a short question.
I'm going to follow up on that because part of what I heard of that as a teacher was what happens if the small bet is made. I'm asked to be the instructor that's gambling and we lose, meaning 3-4 years down the line we decide that technology is gone. I think, though, that goes back to the idea about inviting the instructors in as researchers. And once I think we get instructors in that frame of mind, they're much more accepting of the fact that it will change. Because even if the research is positive and not negative, it still means there's going to be change. And at the end of the day, that's more exciting. I'd much rather know that my colleagues are changing up their classes regularly for good, not evil. And so I think that becomes maybe even just a cultural shift that we're asking of our faculty. Other questions, comments? I have to admit, it's fascinating up here. I think I'm going to dig out my phone so I can take a picture because typically, you know, eyes this way and it's half a sea of eyes pinned that way. Other comments, questions, responses to what you're seeing on the screen? I haven't been paying much attention. Are there back channel conversations that we're seeing up here? That's good. Someone wants to. I don't know if that works. You might have to get up here.
I was wondering the same thing, and I actually, you know, I had written down a tweet to put up about my institution is blah, 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 and then I started thinking about it. And if you really think about that from the 3.0 standpoint, it's about, you know, looking a little bit at your personal ethic, your personal brand, and thinking about that in terms of stewardship of the institution, right? So you put these technologies out there for someone to use, right? If the research says it's not being used, then, you know, the proper type of stewardship is finding a way to back out of that and maybe, you know, explore something else, maybe with that research path that you're working on with the investigator from your faculty or research from your faculty. Maybe, you know, just waiting a little bit and seeing what else turns up in that area that you want to investigate.
I think I'll take a stab at that, though, too. At the end of the day, we're learning institutions, and I think one of the things I like about the image of you 3.0 that we're proposing, or the evolving you, is that it's a constantly learning you. And so back to what we just said, the connection is not remain static. Neither should. But both have maybe traditions of, in the past, being static. Did everyone hear that? Connection to a quote yesterday, and just kind of the idea that as the gatekeepers of technology, we cannot afford not to continue to learn. Did we get some I am you 3.0? Do we have any shout outs on that? Ways that you see yourself or your institution or your communities? I appreciate that connection to community. Well, I think it was interesting even the way you explained it, that it doesn't it seem odd that you're doing it and you're expecting the students to do it, but there's this group in between that you were saying I should be protecting. To me, that speaks volumes that we're expecting of our students but not of the faculty. I think we've hit our time. I want to thank everybody for coming out on, again, Thursday afternoon. I know it was drowsy post-lunch time for a caffeine and sugar fix, so hopefully you're off to doing that before tonight. I hope to see some of you tonight, and the committee will be hoping to do something with all this fun stuff that we've collected. Thank you for contributing to today's presentation as well. Have a good evening.